This is the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America, with Sarah Van Gelder, who's co-founder of Yes Magazine and our author. And it's my pleasure to introduce you to Sarah and this wonderful program tonight. Sarah?
Thank you so much, Anne, and thank you to the Commonwealth Club. I always like to start off by acknowledging the first people of this place. In this case, I believe it's the Ohlone people. Just acknowledgement. And I want to give a huge shout out to you all here in California who are like at the center of the resistance. I mean, all across the country, I've been doing book readings now all over the place, and one of the things I keep coming back to is, well, you know, in California, they're just continuing on with the sanctuary movement. They're not buckling down. We have a new order from our commander-in-chief. California's keeping on, keeping on. And on climate change, California's out there doing the right thing regardless. This is so important because we don't have a lot of time left on the climate crisis. California is not buckling down. There's so many ways across the country that people are showing up, from the Women's March, where there were something like 4 million people on the streets in something like 300 different events, from Moose Pass, Alaska, to Los Angeles, to Lubbock, Texas, to Washington, D.C., where there were probably more than 1 million people there that no one could march because there was no empty spaces left to march into. Just extraordinary energy. And the other thing that I've been inspired by is the people showing up at airports, just saying no to the kind of mean-spirited executive order that came out of the Trump administration, and saying, I got to see one when I landed in Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. at the beginning of my book tour, and just seeing all these signs that just said, we love you, you're welcome here. That kind of outpouring of what we really are all about as a country. So much going on. The bad news is that Donald Trump still is president. He became president without a mandate. He lost the popular vote. He has serious questions of legitimacy because of all the ties with the Russian manipulation of the election, which we are still far from gotten to the bottom of that. And there's all the constitutional questions that have seemed to have faded with the emphasis on the Russians, but there's all the questions about the inviolability clause of the Constitution and how he does or doesn't comply with that. So he's got some enormous questions of legitimacy, and I think we're really in an interesting time right now. I went on a road trip in 2015, the last 4 months of the year. I took a road trip across the United States. I didn't know at the time that the book was going to be launched the Monday after Inauguration Day with a Trump presidency. I had no idea that was going to be happening. But still, there were simmering issues that were really clearly on people's minds. One of them was inequality. There's something like 20 people now in the United States who have more wealth than half of the American population. Just toxic levels of extreme inequality, and they're getting worse, as all the benefits, all the increases from new economic growth and new productivity go to the top 1%. There's the escalating racial tension. We don't have a day go by where we don't have a major incident of some sort. And we know that, you know, I think a lot of people had hoped that with the inauguration of an African-American president, somehow we could close the door on that chapter of our history, and that's so clearly not the case. And it's so clear that we have a lot more work to do in our country to really take that question on. And then we have the existential threat of climate change, which is happening much faster than scientists had predicted. We're feeling the effects now, and I think some people feel like, well, you know, I can get used to in Washington, D.C., 80-degree weather, or Detroit, Michigan, where I was just a few days ago, where it was 70 degrees in February. It was, you know, people, oh, well, I could get used to that. On the other hand, we have questions of whether our agricultural system will survive a massive disruption of water supplies and what will happen to our coastlines. So it's a real existential threat because our civilization evolved with a certain kind of climate, and we are not necessarily well-suited to adapt to something radically different than that. So these were the kinds of questions I was looking at. And these are, in some ways, these are extensions of the kinds of things we've been looking at YES for 20 years. I'm one of the founders of YES magazine. We've been reporting on all sorts of ways that people have been taking on these kinds of issues over the course of the two decades that we've been in publication. But in July 2015, I was sort of looking ahead to our 20th anniversary, and I was just thinking, you know, are we making any progress? Are we making any progress on these really fundamental questions? And I happened to be in Oakland, and I was visiting my friend Akaya Windwood, who runs the Rockwood Institute. And she's one of those people, when you go to talk to her, she doesn't make small talk. She asks really big, tough questions. So I was telling her, you know, that I was feeling a little unclear about next steps. And she said, so, if the universe could deploy the one small person that is you, what would it have you do? And I thought about that for a minute, and I said, without having really thought about it, I said, I think I would go out and look for myself. And when I heard those words, I realized that is exactly what I was going to do. So I went back home and went to the credit union and borrowed some money to buy a little pickup truck and camper. I decided I wanted to have something that flexible. I wanted to go to places that I hadn't been before. I didn't want to just go to the places with big airports and where I'd gone to big conferences. I wanted to go to the backwaters, to the places on the margins, because I think there's something about change that can happen more at the margins of society than happen in the big centers of power. There's something about the reward system that keeps people hooked in to the wealth and power of the status quo in those wealthier parts of the country. And I was just curious, what's going on elsewhere? It's not well reported. So I decided that I was going to find out, go visit those places. But I wanted to go in a camper that was a little more interesting. So I asked my friend Kate Avakana if she would paint it for me. I live on the Suquamish Reservation. It's the land of Chief Seattle. Kate is a Native American artist, and so she agreed to paint a Mother Earth, and she painted two canoes and the canoe paddles. And she did that in part because those represent a journey in general, but also because we go together on the annual canoe journey that the Suquamish tribe takes every year. We go hundreds of miles visiting different tribes around the United States. I'm not Native, but I've been invited to be part of that journey. And this emblem represented the journey that we take together. And at the time, she was dating a guy who is also an artist, but he does big images. He's a muralist. And his name is Toma Villa. So they decided to turn the side of the camper into a giant snail shell. Well, a snail shell made sense because the truck was sort of slow, especially with the weight of the camper. And it also made sense because I was carrying all of my home with me on the back of the truck. And it also made sense because I was practicing a kind of journalism I considered to be slow journalism. So journalism that instead of parachuting in and saying, okay, I got the story, I need your soundbite, I need you to look exotic or colorful, and then I'm going to zip out, it's something very different. It's about staying and listening and hearing people deeply, hearing their stories, and letting their stories determine the kind of reporting I did. So I like the snail shells. And then they decorated the back using ferns and cedar, which is some of the most common greenery where we live in the Pacific Northwest, and used them as stencils and spray painted the back. So I was ready to go on my trip, and I start my book out talking about being in Suquamish before I took off. Because it felt to me and to the editors who, I mean, you know, in a lot of ways I'm very uncomfortable talking about myself and my own experience. I'm much more comfortable reporting on other people. But they said, you know, you got to tell your own story. So I talked about moving to Suquamish in the year 2001. I talked about how when I moved there, I didn't expect to be an activist. I just moved to this reservation because I could afford a small house there. And then shortly after I'd been there, my neighbors knocked on the door and told me that we, these other non-Native people who are living on the reservation, had to be united against the tribe because the tribe wanted to build housing in our neighborhood. And it was one of those situations where I couldn't be silent and not be caught up in being associated with that point of view. So I went to a meeting at the local church. I heard one person after another get up and explain why we didn't want those kinds of people in our neighborhood. And finally, of course, I had to speak up and say, of course the tribe has a right to build housing on their own reservation. Then I decided it was a good idea to leave the meeting early. And someone followed me out, and it turned out to be an elder with the tribe. And I was mortified to realize that he had been listening to that whole story, that whole set of really unpleasant comments. And he assured me, you know, we're okay. We have a great legal department. We're going to build the housing. In fact, the housing is now on a little street that has been named We Won. So the housing did get built, and so we went our separate ways. But a few weeks later, Chief Seattle's grave was desecrated. And I was new in that town. I sort of waited for the usual human rights leaders to step up and say something so I could get behind them. And nobody stepped up and said anything, except for, of course, members of the tribe. So I found that elder, whose name is Ted George, and the two of us started an organization that we called Suquamish Olala Neighbors. And we didn't really know what we were going to do once we responded to that particular grave desecration incident. But with his guidance, we did several things. We started off by educating ourselves, those of us who are non-Natives, on the history of the Suquamish people and the Native people of the Pacific Northwest. And we showed up at meetings where this group of neighbors who had been so hostile, they used to show up in moderately large numbers and pass themselves off as representing the non-tribal community. So we started showing up in even larger numbers and saying, no, actually, there's a lot more of us who respect the tribe and respect their rights and their sovereignty. So they started having more political space to operate within because they were now in a friendlier context. And the other thing we did, and this was another one of the things that I so appreciated about the elder, he said, you know, people are always telling us about how broken our community is. And of course, like reservations everywhere, there's lots of problems there, drug abuse and people who are in despair after generations of really harsh conditions. And he said, we don't need to hear any more about how broken we are. We need to lift up the people who are bringing us together, who are healing us, and who are taking us forward. So we started having a series of annual potlucks. And each potluck, we would raise up two or three or four people from the tribal community, from the non-tribal community, who are bringing the community together. And often those were women, often they were young people. They were often doing things and weren't getting a lot of attention. But we were able to stand them up in front of their community and shower them with praise, give them gifts, tell them how much we appreciate that. It might have been a young woman who was teaching the Native language to other young people, or it was a librarian who was making sure that the kids at the local elementary school got to learn how baskets were made using reeds that grew in Native swamplands. So we did that for some time, and then we had an opportunity at one point to work to see if we could get some land returned where Chief Seattle used to live. This was where the largest longhouse in the region was located, and 600 to 900 foot long longhouse. And it was land that was sacred to the tribe because it was the center of their village, as well as being where Chief Seattle and other very highly respected chiefs had lived. And after 2 years of working together, we were able to get that done. So in 2004, 100 years after when that land was taken from the tribe, it was returned. So we did all this work over the course of a number of years, and one of the things that I was really struck by was that even though some of it was quite oppositional, we got better as a community. We got along better. Things worked better. And even the folks that had been hostile at first, they found other ways to be involved in the civic activities of the community, like working on other parks instead of the one that they were trying to keep the tribe from getting back. So things got better over time, and one of the things I started wondering about as I was getting ready to take my road trip was, I wonder if there are other communities that have taken on racism in whatever form it comes up in their particular community with success. I wonder if there are ways in which this happens better in place-based communities where people work together over time to really get to the roots of something than just through policies. Because as important as voting rights is and as important as anti-discrimination policies are, we have to get to the cultural foundations of racism. And that takes deeper work. So I wanted to find out, were there other communities that were doing that? So I went across the country. I went about 12,000 miles, went to 18 different states, 5 Indian reservations. I'm not quite sure how many cities and towns. I wasn't sure exactly where I was going, but I started from Seattle because that's where I lived. And then I wanted to go to several main areas of the country. I wanted to go to the Mountain West, which is not an area I'd spent a lot of time in. I spent my time on the coast. And of course, the Mountain West is a much more conservative area. I wanted to go to the Rust Belt because it's been so left behind by the economy. I wanted to get to Appalachia and the South. And I wanted to spend a little bit of time in the Southwest.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America, with Sarah Van Gelder. Sarah?
Thank you, Ann. So the first place I went was to the state of Montana. And just a little background on this, I had been following a story nearby where the Lummi tribe, which is north of Seattle, had been fighting a large coal terminal, what would have been the largest in the United States. And this, they were so clear that they did not want this terminal that they in fact went out on a beach and burned a giant check that was stamped non-negotiable to make really clear that they were not accepting money in exchange for permission to build a terminal that would have disrupted their way of life and disrupted their fisheries. So at the time, they were in the midst of this struggle, and I got really curious, why would they suddenly need the largest brand new coal terminal in the United States at a time when mostly coal seems to be on the way out? And I found out that the coal was going to be coming from a brand new coal mine in a place in southeast Montana called the Otter Creek Valley. It's a quiet valley that's now being ranched, that's been ranched for generations by some of the same families. This would have been the largest coal mine in the entire state of Montana. So I went there. And I spent some time with Elena Buffalo Spirit and some of the other members of the Northern Cheyenne tribe. Elena Buffalo Spirit's land is right on the Tongue River, and immediately across the river is where a new railroad spur would have been built to transport the coal to the main line. So I camped on her land and interviewed her and other tribal members, and she talked about being a grandmother, and she said, "What would I tell my grandchildren if they asked me what I had done?" And she says, at least they might ask me that, and I'll be able to say, here are the articles, and here are the records, and I spoke up for you. So for her, this was such an important thing to be involved in. I also found out that the Lummi tribe had, some carvers from the Lummi tribe had carved a totem pole and were bringing it out as a gift to the Northern Cheyenne tribe, because both of them were on either end of this coal project. So as an act of solidarity, they were bringing a totem pole to the Northern Cheyenne tribe, and I wanted to be there when the ceremony took place. And when it took place, it was both people from those two tribes, but it was also the ranchers in the area who were there. And so I interviewed the ranchers about what their feelings about this project were. I talked to Roger Sprague, whose family has been on the land since 1881, and he told me, when I ride horseback through this country, we find arrowheads and teepee rings and places where indigenous people lived, and we respect that, and we want to protect it, just like my family history. We want to protect that too. And he said, we're on sacred land. But that's not how Arch Cole sees things. He said, this coal is to make big corporations a lot of money, and they'll do it on the backs of us small ranchers. So the ceremony went on with both folks from the two different tribes and ranchers making statements. And I remember thinking as I listened, they're using some of the same language. They're talking about having inherited this beautiful land from previous generations and their sacred responsibility to pass it along intact to future generations. That's a sacred responsibility. And because they feel so strongly about it, they're willing to work awfully hard to keep that mind from going in. When I got back, I found that they had, in fact, prevailed. The Arch Coal gave up on the mine project. They cited a number of things, and certainly economics had a part to play. But they also talked about regulatory uncertainty, which is code word for the persistence of the protesters. So I thought about, you know, they worked over years together. They worked doing the dull work of reading environmental impact statements, going to the state capitol, going to Washington, D.C. They did that because they had that kind of deep commitment to their place and to one another. And then I thought about what they won. They won the continuation of their own way of life on that beautiful land. They also won a real benefit for everyone who's in between, who would have been breathing the coal dust from all of those trainloads of coal and having coal dust getting into their water. So all those people get a cleaner air and cleaner water as a result, including folks in the city of Seattle. And then there's the folks in China or in other parts of Asia who would have received all of that 1.2 billion tons of coal, many of whom are already dying from all sorts of pollution-related causes. So that's 1.2 billion tons of coal that will not be going up in the atmosphere and getting into people's lungs. And then I thought, well, it benefits all of us, because with the climate crisis the way it is, with the atmosphere already saturated with carbon, none of us can afford to have that much more carbon put into the atmosphere. So these three relatively powerless groups of people were able to do that much work because of their deep commitment to their place and to one another. So another story from Kentucky. I spent time in Appalachia, which is coal country. Lots of issues that are very much in the news about what it means to be in coal country, including having mountaintops blown up and rivers filled in with the debris. But I visited this one little community called Whitesburg, Kentucky, that's working on making Appalachia great again, but not by reviving coal and not by advocating white supremacy. In fact, what they're looking at is a very different model for how they can move into the future. This is led by an organization called Apple Shop, and they're one of the groups that was involved in, they go way back to doing all kinds of work over the years in bringing Appalachian culture, music, art, theater, making all of those kinds of things possible, including filmmaking that features Appalachian filmmakers telling their own story about their community rather than having other people tell the story of who they are. They've been fighting, I don't mean Apple Shop as an organization, I think they would object to that, but people associated with that have been among the people opposing a proposed $450 million prison that was proposed to be built on the top of one of those blasted off mountaintops. And there's all sorts of reasons why it's a really poor idea. And unfortunately, it looks like it's going to be going through anyway because of the political clout of the congressional delegation from Kentucky. But they've been pressing for a different kind of economic development model. When I visited, I had a chance to sit down with their new director, a 20-something African-American, formerly a corporate attorney, who chose to come to Appalachia and take a big cut in pay because he felt like this was a place where he could really make a contribution. And I asked him, you know, what is it like to be one of the only African Americans for miles around? And he said, there's a lot of racism. It's what you would expect. It has been awful. And then he said something else, which I found kind of stunning. He said, in spite of what he's up against every day, he talked about how the Appalachian people are constantly ridiculed in the press, how they're talked about as barefoot hillbillies, people without teeth or people without toilets. And he says, that's funny to people? That's not a tragedy we have to solve? And he says, I don't know why that's funny. People grow up seeing themselves depicted on television as the Beverly Hillbillies or the Simpsons. Many just want to leave. There's a lot of self-hate in this region. So one of the people that's been working on that question for a long time and who herself left Appalachia is Ada Smith. She grew up in that small community, and she wanted to leave when she got old enough to be able to leave. She came to Olympia and Seattle, and she was just so excited to be around all these hip young people, and she came out as queer, and she was just having a really great time. But then she started noticing that everybody was stereotyping her as a redneck, and calling her homophobic and racist because they picked up her Kentucky accent, and they assumed that must be true of her. And after a while, she decided to go home. And she decided to go to a place that she felt had given her so much so that she could give back and she could be among her people, but still pushing for the things that she cares a lot about. She's one of the DJs on WMMT, which is Apple Shop's radio station, which they call the voice of the mountain people's music, culture, and social issues. And although Appalachia is predominantly white, they have 7 jails and penitentiary within their listening areas that are made up of predominantly African Americans. So part of their programming is a Monday night program called Hip Hop on the Hilltop. She's one of the DJs for that. And one day somebody called in asking the station to convey a message to one of the prison inmates, because it can be very difficult and very expensive to get through to people on the inside. And so they conveyed that message, and then they realized there was a real need for that kind of communication. So now every week for 2 hours, they leave their phone answering machine on, and people call in with messages for people on the inside. And they take all of those messages and they splice them together, and for a full hour every Monday night after the hip-hop show, they have nothing but those messages from people's friends and families. And most of those are very simple. They're shout-outs to loved ones. They're, you know, keep your chin up, or your sister had a baby, or we love you and can't wait for you to come home. And Ada told me, you know, she knows exactly what that impact of that is. They get lots of love letters from the people inside the prisons. But she knows she's also telling a story to the white folks who are so eager to have new prisons built in their community. She's telling them a story that there are human beings who are behind those bars. So a third place, Cincinnati, Ohio. I had a conversation with a pediatric surgeon by the name of Dr. Victor Garcia, who works at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. And he told me that Cincinnati is among the most segregated cities in the United States, with child poverty second only to Detroit. He says children as young as 6 years old are getting hypertension. He said life expectancy differs by 20 years between neighborhoods that are as close as half a mile from each other. And he talked about PTSD that are at rates that veterans have coming back from war. So these are deeply traumatized communities. And as a surgeon, he realized that the health of his patient was much more important, dependent on the context of their lives, the poverty and the hopelessness. And he kind of had one of those epiphanies when he had to tell the mother of a 14-year-old child that her daughter was not going to live as a result of a gunshot wound. So he felt like, you know, as a medical professional, he needed to understand how to move upstream, how to take on the causes of that kind of violence. And he feels that a lot of that has to do with the economy. The economy is creating that kind of poverty. The economy can also address it. And his view is that it's really important that that new economy have an ownership stake for people in all those communities. So what that means, Cincinnati has this major worker ownership movement going on. It's a movement that involves the unions, it involves the faith community, and it even involves representatives from the Mondragon Cooperatives in Spain, one of the largest conglomerates of co-ops anywhere in the world. So a few examples. This is Flecker Vera, who is one of the worker owners of Sustainergy, which is a worker-owned company that weatherizes businesses and homes. And the worker-owned, there's a new cooperative that also has two farms, both within close proximity to the city of Cincinnati or within its boundaries. And they also have a food hub so that they can bring food from those farms, but also from other sources of food and sell them to some of the major buyers. And as a result of that, they're able to give the farmers a consistent source of demand for their produce. And they're also in the process of refurbishing an old grocery store into a new worker-owned co-op. And it's really interesting how these different threads are coming together in Cincinnati, because the unions have decided to be involved because they've been on a losing battle for so long. And they're starting to realize that if their members don't actually own part of the economy, they're never going to be out of that losing battle. And the faith community has gotten involved in part because there's a Old Testament theologian, Walter Brueggemann, who's doing a lot of speaking there, and got them fired up about the Jubilee. Because, you know, in the Old Testament, there's all this discussion about freeing the slaves and returning the land and relieving the debt. And we have those same three issues today with people deeply indebted, people enslaved either through human trafficking or incarcerated in massive numbers, the highest of any country in the world. And we have this massive inequality, which in the Old Testament world was about land ownership and today is about wealth. So we have these same three issues. So the faith community is on fire about this. So it's really an interesting group of different interests that are all getting involved in this question of how do you get worker ownership going? How do you get workers to own manufacturing, for example? And a lot of people say, well, manufacturing is never going to come back. But if you take out the amount of money that has to, in manufacturing in the traditional system, has to go to Wall Street, has to go to big CEOs, that if you no longer have to pay that kind of money, you can have a very different system that's built on enough, not maximizing profits. So it's built on producing what needs to be produced, earning enough money to pour back into the business and keep it going, but it doesn't have to be exorbitant profits. It's a really different foundation for the economy. In Cincinnati, Ohio, right in the heart of the Rust Belt, is one of the places where that's unfolding in really interesting ways. The last place I'll tell you about is Newark, New Jersey. It's one of the only places that I went to where I was curious about what government was doing. And the reason I was because I have a new mayor by the name of Ross Baraka, and he came out of 20 years of doing community organizing in communities in Newark, New Jersey, and actually had been running for mayor almost that long. But he was elected just 2 years before I got there, and I was really curious to find out, well, what has he done now that he's been elected and his team is getting to make some calls? So this was one of the cases where crowdsourcing helped. I didn't know anybody there, but a friend of a friend got on my Facebook and said, hey, I can introduce you to those folks, and they did, so I went. And the thing that I focused on while I was there was that they had chosen two neighborhoods to make model neighborhoods. These are neighborhoods that have in particular been left behind and impoverished for many years. And they decided that they would focus on bringing them out of poverty and started with murals as a way to show the community that they were serious about the importance of those neighborhoods and about them being beautiful and places that did have a future. So they did murals on all sorts of different walls. They negotiated with property owners who had walls and said, you know, it'd be okay if we did some artwork here, and negotiated about what would go on the walls, because not everybody was comfortable with every image. In one case, there was a property owner who had advertising on the top of the wall, and he wanted to keep that, so that was part of the negotiation, and the bottom of the wall was available. And the wall also happened to be right against a sidewalk. So the artist who was doing the work there decided to use that as a way to hear from people in the community about their feelings and make sure to incorporate that into the artwork as he worked. And he also decided to leave intact the graffiti that was already there and work it into the artwork. And I didn't really realize it until I went back later and looked at my photographs and found a piece that really struck me. It said, "We the people love this place. And then it says, in fact, we, the people, call this place our home. And I felt like it was a really important statement that even some of the cities that we in the larger country may think of as basket cases, for people who live in those communities, that is their home. That's where their children were raised. That's where their memories were created. And then also, there was a mural that said something else that I thought was really important. It said, we can observe the future when our vision is uplifted. Because revitalization isn't only about bringing beauty to forgotten places. It's also about unleashing creativity and entrepreneurship and recognizing that we, the people, have the capacity and the right to love a place and to make it even better. And it actually reminded me of some of the things that the Montana ranchers had said. And it made me think how much importance there is to loving a place and to feeling that sense of ownership and the rights of being from a place when we think of where our power comes from. So with that, I returned to my home in Suquamish to write The Revolution Where You Live.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile journey through a new America with Sarah Van Gelder, co-founder, Yes Magazine, and author. And we've come to that time in our program tonight for our questions. And we have several questions. So let me relay them to you. The first one is, what relevance did concepts like civic duty have in your conversations? Are Americans truly, quote, citizens of their republic, unquote?
I think that that Americans, maybe there's something too big and abstract about the United States. We have so many different parts of our country. And although I think there's always the attempt to talk about patriotism, I think the deeper love is often of a specific place. I think that's where we can have the emotional connections of being with family, being with neighbors, getting to know the natural environment. I think there's something really important about deeply knowing the particular trees, the particular animals, the particular patterns of birds that come through a particular place. And when things get too abstract, I think we start getting a little bit confused, which I think sometimes happens with national patriotism. I think it can turn into a kind of nationalism that becomes quite ugly. So I think if you ask people around the country how they feel, I think an awful lot of the people would tell you from their heart the kind of connection they feel to their particular place.
Do you think they also have a view about when someone says civic duty?
I think that's language that that may or may not resonate with people. It may be a generational thing, but I think that there's a sense that that connection that's reciprocal may be more. Maybe more what people actually experience. In other words, it's kind of like Ada Smith from Appalachia. She said, this community gave me so much. I'm paraphrasing here. It's not a quote. She talked about, this community gave me so much, and now I want to give back. So that sense of reciprocity, I got so much, I want to give back to that. So duty may or may not be the word that people would, that I didn't hear a lot of the use of that particular term.
This question is also from the audience. There are more poor women having babies than rich women. How would you provide for all these poor babies?
This was not a question that I explored on my road trip. I was looking primarily at the three questions of inequality and climate change and racism. And I think my understanding from other research I've done is that people, when they're in a situation where they're feeling secure, people tend to have fewer children. because they have control over their lives, and because they can see a future for themselves and for their children that may be better if they have fewer children. So statistically, people who are doing better off have fewer children. You can look at those numbers around the world. So my sense is that that our best solution for children and other living things is to work on an economic system in which everyone has access to the things they need to be healthy and well, including access to contraception, but that everybody is taken care of.
What is your vision for some powerful, effective ways to heal? These are tough questions, by the way. To heal the ever-widening divide we are witnessing in our nation.
So I think there's a number of different kinds of divides, and this, in fact, the whole book is really has a lot of aspects of that, of healing that divide. There's the economic divide. So how do we deal with massive inequality? I think the answers have to do with building a very different kind of an economy that's locally rooted, that's widely available for people to participate in, where people can be involved, people who may not have any assets now can be involved in worker co-ops so they can start having an ownership share in the economy. Other people might have small businesses. But an economy that's not about extracting the wealth from communities and extracting the wealth from nature, an economy that's about reciprocity with place. So in terms of the economic divides, I think that's the direction to go. In terms of racial divides, I think the question is a deep one that will take generations to resolve. And I think it's one that we, as those of us who are white folks, have a huge responsibility to step up and get involved in. I think we've often characterized that as something where people of color lead and we maybe follow. But I think we have to lead, because I think really the issue sort of in many cases centers on white privilege and how much of that privilege are we prepared to give up and how much of the culture are we prepared to really transform. The political divide, that's a big one that's in the news right now. The left-right divide, it isn't even a left-right divide anymore. That's not really even germane. You know, I think that when you look at how many people who were Bernie supporters, then jumped over to be Trump supporters. It's a different divide. I think it's almost an insider-outsider divide. I think there were a bunch of people that were so sure that they wanted to see change, that they were willing to vote for Trump even though they could see that he was only partially making sense. So I think there's a huge insider-outsider divide. There is a left-right. You know, there's all sorts of different divides. But what I found really interesting when I was traveling was that at a local community level, it's a different kind of a thing, because people are not so easily pigeonholed. When there's somebody that you're going to see at the grocery store, or your kids are going to go to school with them, or your kids are going to grow up with them and might even marry them, it's a really different kind of relationship. And so I think there's something really pernicious about social media. As much as I use it, and I think it's a good organizing tool, we can so easily pigeonhole people when all we know is what they said in 140 characters. But it's a lot harder to do if we're sitting across a table drinking coffee with somebody. So I think one of the most important tasks we have to do right now is to really reconnect in our communities. And maybe let me just say a few other things as sort of a wrap-up for this, because I think reconnection is at the heart of everything else we need to do. We have a toxic level of isolation in our country where people are so lonely. This has been a trend over decades where people know fewer and fewer people and have fewer and fewer people in their lives that they trust. And as they do that, I think there's all kinds of toxic effects. In fact, the research shows that it's as toxic as cigarette smoking to our health. So it's having real impacts on us. And when we spend a lot of the time that we used to spend with actual human beings, instead watching them on screens, telling us anything from truth to out and out lies, I think it becomes harder to distinguish truth from fabrication. So I think one of the most important things we have to do is get out from behind those screens and get into places with other people who we form long-term relationships with in our civic spaces. And those have to include people who are different than ourselves. So right after the election, I was at Standing Rock there when the election took place, and I wasn't expecting it to be what it turned out to be. But I remember climbing out of my icy tent on election morning, hoping I was going to hear different news than I heard. And when I realized what had happened, I called up my colleagues at Yes, and I told them, you know, I just wrote a column, but I need to write something different. Can you hold that one? So the column I actually wrote was about how important it is in our communities to reach out to one another when a disaster happens. Because there are communities that are especially vulnerable. There are communities that are especially vulnerable right now. Those include undocumented folks. They include Muslims. They include people of color more generally. Now it turns out they also include journalists and Jews. And they could include healthcare workers and could include school teachers who have the audacity to teach about evolution. So there's all kinds of groups that are being targeted and could be targeted. And we don't really know who those are going to be. What we do know is the famous quote from Nazi Germany. You know, they came for the communist. I wasn't a communist, so I didn't stand up. And they came for the trade unionists, and I wasn't a trade unionist, so I didn't. I'm garbling the quote, I'm sure. But the end result is, when they came for me, there was no one left to stand up for me. So it's absolutely essential that we reach out to one another in place-based communities, not just over the internet, not just saying, hey, I see you out there on Twitter, but in person. And then we have the foundations, because we have the trust to show up in public space. So we have the foundations for rebuilding power. We have the trust to know that we're going to be safe, or at least that somebody's going to have our back. So if somebody comes and paints a swastika on my front porch, I know you'll be there with paint and help me paint it over, and then we'll go out and have drinks. Or if it's time to go to our member of Congress and let them know what we think, we'll go. And we'll go again, and we'll go again, because we're going together. And so we'll support one another, and we'll nourish our soul. So instead of activism becoming a source of burnout, it becomes a source of exuberance and love and appreciation. And then from that foundation, we can also do the third thing. So we have the reconnect, resist, and the revitalize. We can do the third thing, which is to not forget about our beautiful dreams, to do what California is doing, to keep on keeping on with wonderful climate solutions, to keep on being sanctuary cities, to make our cities and our towns and our communities what we want them to be. So on that foundation, I think we really can bring the revolution home.
There's an interesting question, by the way, to follow up. Did you have respectful conversations with, quote, angry white people, end of the quote? Were these questions, these conversations, quote, different, end of quote, or different insights?
So this was before the election, and I wasn't, the end of 2015, the election had not heated up, and I wasn't looking for that. So I wasn't seeking out the places where people were angry with one another. I did talk to people. For example, some of those ranchers that I talked to, they said, you know, I voted for George W. Bush. Nobody was really thinking Trump yet, but, you know, I voted for George W. Bush. So there were certainly people in the communities that I visited and people I talked to who were Republicans, but they were thinking about something else. They were thinking about their communities, and that's what I was there to talk to them about. So, no, I wasn't actually subjected to much anger.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Unfortunately, we have reached that point in our program for our last question. It's a very interesting question, I think. Talking about your presentation tonight, these are wonderful vignettes of people taking control of their futures. Is there any sense of understanding of how their communities got into trouble in the first place? So that knowledge can be spread and their mistakes avoided elsewhere?
It's a complicated question. I think anybody who has asked that in any community, there would be many, many different stories that people would tell you about how a community became troubled. Some would go all the way back to 1492 and say, you know, this whole enterprise of colonialism has some real problems, and there is a lot of folks who were displaced from their land who shouldn't have been. They would go back to the question of the transatlantic slave trade and say, you know what, people were brought here in chains and their labor was extracted for generations, and their poverty is very much linked to that. And at the same time, the wealth of the United States was built on that extracted land and that extracted labor. And some people have benefited from that more than others. We did an article in Yes Magazine about a family from New England that was really upstanding, wonderful, progressive family, lots of professors and lots of pastors. And they did a little bit of research into their own history and found out that their family wealth came from being prominent in the transatlantic slave trade. So they had not been part of the plantation system, but they had become enormously wealthy from being in the trade. And so many progressives in the North like to project all the slavery, you know, bad karma on the South. Well, it's not so easy if you actually look at it. The whole Industrial Revolution with cotton and accumulation of vast amounts of money was built on appropriated land and appropriated labor. So, you know, if you ask the question, how did this particular community get into so much trouble? You'd have to ask a lot of parts to that question, right? I mean, you could go more recently and you could say, well, how many, what happened to the Rust Belt? Why are so many people unemployed in the Rust Belt? What happened to those jobs? And there's an argument now about how much of it was because of automation, how much of it was because of those jobs being outsourced to places where wages are even lower than in the United States. Well, probably some of both. So what if we had a different kind of an economy where instead of trying to extract the most wealth out of people's work, the point was to meet the needs of folks by producing what people actually need to eat and to live well and to pay them well? What if we had that kind of an economy? So, you know, if you ask the question, how did a community get into so much trouble? I think it would be a really interesting question, and it would take some real honest looking in the mirror as well as looking back to examine what's real about how each community in the country got to where it is today and how we as an entire nation got to where we are today. Because we have a lot of work to do. We're not in a good space right now with this the direction that our new president is taking us. There's a potential for real, even deeper divides, even more violence, and even more economic dislocation. So we have some work to do, and I think actually looking in the mirror and looking at that history is not a bad place to start to really understand where we go from here. Thank you very much. I encourage you to read The Revolution Where You Live and check out our website, revolutionwhereyoulive.org.
This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Our program tonight is The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-mile Journey Through a New America, with Sarah Van Gelden, co-founder of Yes Magazine and author. And I'd like to share with you that several years ago, I can't remember quite when, we did a program on mountaintop mining, and that was a program that I did as a programmer and also as someone who was very interested in the southeastern part of the United States because I was actually born and raised in Alabama. which at the time was a very difficult place to live for many, many people. But in the program, and I'll share this with you tonight, I didn't think I even had forgotten perhaps, the thing that stood out to me about mountaintop mining and the communities was the lack, the very large lack of medical and dental facilities and programs, that there were actually vans that went from community to community, either treating medical problems or dental problems. And they went to these small communities, and they did it maybe once or twice a year. So I personally never forgot that there is something in terms of the mining and everything that went on, and the segregation and everything on, that caused terrific harm to many, many people. And in a way, we need to continue to recognize that and build on the kind of communities that Sarah has been talking about and sharing with us tonight. So thank you all for coming. But first, let's give a big hand to Sarah Van Gelder. And many thanks to our audiences here and on the radio and the internet. Find our programs on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. Click on our website, watch and listen for Commonwealth Club videos, radio schedules, and subscribe to our weekly free podcast and program archives. This is Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. Thank you for being with us. And a big hand before you leave for both our audience and the radio audience with us. So one more big hand. Thank you for being with us. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.